Welcome back
to the Tiny Bookcase. I'm Ben.
And I am Nico. What you're about to hear is an interview.
A damn good one too. Prepare to learn.
If you enjoy hearing this guest talk, be sure to check out last week's episode where you can hear their story.
Ours too, if you're so inclined.
So, without further ado,
on with the show.
Right, I think it's time to ask you some questions. You know, I think I've already had a good time and you've been quite enlightening, actually. So
yeah,
let us dig your brain for more details.
That's
what is
enough.
The first book you remember reading?
The first book I remember reading is a book by the children's writer and illustrator John Birmingham, called The Tale of Borka, the Goose Who Had No Feathers, which was a beautiful little story about a lost goose in sort of London's docklands and her journey towards finding her own people again. And I must have been, I don't know, 4 when my mum first got that out the library for me, and I really think she was probably sick of it by the time I was 6, because I borrowed it so many times and she was always having to read it to me. And that's one of the books that helped me learn to read, I'm sure. And certainly the themes of outsiders and London and personal journeys, they're all there.
Definitely had a big effect on you then, because I think for a lot of people, picture books and, you know, your the very, very young books sort of melt into one amorphous, hungry, caterpillary, patchworky, elephanty mess.
I love that too. I love the hungry caterpillar as well. Yeah.
That one goes without saying.
Yeah.
It is an interesting point, though, this idea that one stands out really, really clearly for you from those books, because I don't think, for me, those really early books...
They were really sort of precious. I mean, that one, and there's also a book that I still possess, which was my mum's old copy of Hans Andersen's Fairy Tales, and it's a beautiful book with colour plates. It must date from the 50s, and you know, every picture, you know, you learn by heart, and I did learn these stories by heart. They were, you know, I loved stories from such a young age, and I began writing them myself when I was like, basically as soon as I learned to form letters, and I drew my own pictures and wrote stories to go with them. It just seemed like an entirely natural activity. It was very much a part of my world.
That's really lovely. You mentioned getting the book out of the library for a couple of years. Were you a real library kid? Did you...
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, like, literally totally. I could afford, I had, like, with my pocket money, I could probably afford to buy one paperback book a month. Mm. And then I'd get books for Christmas, always books for Christmas. But we couldn't afford anywhere near all the books I wanted to read. And I was just, it would be constant. It was like every week I'd go and I'd get 6 new books, and then I'd walk to the library, get more, the school library as well. There was never a time when there weren't a stack of library books by my bed, and the smell of them even now. I mean, I actually like getting Ex Libris copies secondhand, because you get that particular texture of the particular plastic coverings they put on them, and the stamp, you know, where you'd stamp the books. And I'm old enough to, you know, pre-computerization, I remember when our library went computer, and before that you had the little cardboard slips where you'd slip into the little, you know, pockets. I mean, I remember that's just such a...
I also remember those, actually, but that may have been because I grew up for a little while in the sort of wilds in the north, so I think possibly digitization hadn't quite caught up on the libraries there, but
just got
It got there just after I left, I think.
I libraries are just a fundamental part of my reading memory. And they're so important. I mean, I know things are changing, and I know that as somebody in their mid-50s, you know, who grew up a certain way, I can't speak for what kids need now and what's important for them now. And of course, there is a huge increase in access to printed material online. I do understand that, and I'm not going to be preachy about libraries, but I can't imagine a world in which libraries are not important in some way.
It's for just them, isn't it?
Yeah, and just providing a kind of a hub, you know, for people to go to meet to see what books are available. Even they just should be upheld, and they certainly in my generation, I know they were a vital source of books and knowledge and the idea of writing, that I wouldn't have been the same person without.
Did the two of you used to have a thing that your library would do in the summer where they'd say you get a sticker or a stamp or whatever for every book you read, and if you fill up all 10 slots you get a certificate or whatever?
Our school library did things like that from now and then. Yeah, reading projects.
I was a voracious reader, as I'm sure both of you are. I know that Ben was, and it sounds like you were. And I did it in the first 3 days. I took loads of books home, and it was the summer holidays, and I was a type 1 diabetic child in the 90s. I couldn't go anywhere, so I just ploughed through these bloody books. And we went back, and the woman didn't believe me.
That you'd read them, yeah.
I'd read them and tried to quiz me on them.
I love it.
Briefly flicking through the synopses on each one.
That's fantastic, yeah.
Oh, what strange people. What strange times.
Wonderful. Yeah. So, this one's quite a fun one. What is a secret talent that few people know about that you possess?
A secret talent? Oh, I can touch... I can touch the tip of my nose with the tip of my tongue. I'm really glad we're not on video.
That's an amazing one. I definitely can't do that, I think.
Did you just try, Ben?
Yes, of course I did.
It's like something that, when, you know, through my childhood, like at Christmas parties and stuff, my dad would just go on, do it.
Party trick for a child.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, used it for anything fascinating, like picking a lock while held captive, or
that would be far more useful.
briefly pause as I take my co-host aside to describe how tongues work, and then we'll resume. I've definitely got the flat, short tongue of a cow.
They're massive, those things. I think you'll find.
Oh yeah, they are, aren't they? I guess.
I think it's just because cows are generally quite big.
Yeah. Oh, I like that one. And this is something that few people know about. Just your dad.
Well, like people who knew me before the age of 15 all know. I'm sure I've done it a few times more recently when I was drunk, but I obviously am blessedly ignorant of those.
I guess it's not the kind of thing that just sort of happens accidentally at a bus stop, is it?
No.
Your next writer's panel, you know.
Getting scary now.
That would be actually an exceptional way to freak somebody out, wouldn't it? I'd definitely run
it
the other way.
It looks disgusting. I mean, like, I've never done, like, since the time that I did it in front of a mirror just to see what it looked like, I don't think I've done it since.
Barely lick my own moustache. This is...
I really don't want to hear about you licking your own moustache.
Moving on.
Yes, let's move on. Your favourite story.
My favourite story. That's a really, really difficult one.
To be a book. It can be just the concept. If you said a hero's journey, though, we're kicking you out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to say The Time Machine, because again, this was a H.G. Wells's The Time Machine.
Yes.
This was a really, really seminal book. We talked about the first book I remember reading, Borka, but I think the first book that I read that had a profound influence, on me as a reader, as a thinker, and potentially as a future writer, was H.G. Wells's The Time Machine. And there's something about that story that is, it's just a sort of immortal, flexible story. You can see, you know, the modern day incarnation in something like Doctor Who, where you've just got this very, very simple idea that you can do more or less anything with. You know, person has time machine, will travel. Yeah. And that is essentially the whole of Doctor Who. And what I love about it in H.G. Wells's version is I love the build up. I love it. It starts as what you'd call a club story, where you've got all these different guys as they were, you know, crotchety. You've got the teacher, you've got the doctor, you've got the skeptic, you've got the believer, and they're all gathered in, you know, in a Victorian drawing room with the clock ticking and the tea being brought in. And then somebody bursts into the room with an unbelievable story that's going to change all their lives. And I absolutely love that. And I love, you know, sort of the bit that a lot of younger readers, I'm sure, skipped over, which is like, well, how does this thing work? And there's like the little time machine, the prototype that he builds to start with, and it's in this little wooden case, and it's glittering and it's beautiful, and he sends it off into infinity, because of course there's nobody seated on the miniature prototype time machine who's able to send it back, so it's gone forever. And that utterly entranced and kind of mildly horrified me, because I'm one of those weird people that get very fond of inanimate objects, and so of course I was always, oh my god, what's happened to it? And I reread that book regularly, and it hasn't dated at all. It's stunning archetypical science fiction, and I love it, and it's traveled with me through my life. And I think in the introduction to my first what I call story cycle, which is a book of linked stories, The Silver Wind, I think I pay homage to it and credit it and say that set of stories was at least kick-started by The Time Machine.
What a wonderful answer. Because it really is a really captivating story. And that you mentioned that bit about just sending it off into infinity. There's a certain idea of like the permanence of it as well, which, because I read this quite young too, and I was shocked by it. Not in the same way that you were, I think, you know, where's it gone? What? But I was shocked at the idea of not being able to get back.
Oh.
Yes.
I found that very scary. So yeah, no, that's a fabulous answer to the favorite story. H.G. Wells getting it. I love it. So in terms of when you come to write a story, so you've credited The Time Machine. When you actually come to writing your own like flash fiction or short stories or even short stuff like novellas, what's your process for that?
Oh my goodness. It's so difficult to give a general overarching answer, because my process of writing is so organic. Sure. As I say, with the one that we've just explored with Empty Tank, that was just boom. I have to tell you, I've never written Flash in my life. That's the shortest story I've ever written.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I did one last year for Radio 4, which was 2,000 words. And I thought I was never going to be able to do that. And then when, you know, this one was even shorter, I thought, oh, my God. And it just fitted. And but
like a see-through insect to water, I've got to tell you.
Yeah. Well, it's a challenge, and I like that. I like the idea of like, can I do it? And then of course I've got to challenge myself and prove that I can. But I tend to be more rambly, I tend to be more discursive, and my whole process of writing novels is what I'd call extremely wasteful. I write a lot, I delete a lot. I've many times discarded great tranches of work, 30,000 words and more, without blinking, because I've, in the process of writing those words, all I have come to learn is that was the wrong place to begin. And once I know that, I, you know, there's always more words. Words are what I do. I do not need to be scared of gunning several thousand words if I know that they are not leading me down the right path. So I will do that. And I discover my fiction in the process of writing it. I will begin very much with a character, an outline situation, you know, with the flash fiction Empty Tank. I began with the idea that, oh my God, yeah, somebody's going to get a load of creef loose in their house somehow. And then I got this guy who I didn't like very much, but I quite like writing from the point of view of people I don't like, because that it makes it really, I just enjoy it, because you can then let rip. And that was fun. But it just, I'm not going to say it wrote itself, but it almost did. It just followed. But longer pieces are not so easily trainable, mainly entirely down to my own very bad habit of wanting to follow too many story threads. And I will end up getting interested in too many things, putting a load of things in, having to cut stuff out. And sometimes this is useful. The novella I mentioned earlier, Maggots, was originally a section of The Rift. And I realized that I was about 50,000 words in, and I thought, I've got way too much going on. This character, Willie, is going to have to bite the dust. But I loved him so much, and I loved his story so much, I just took him out, put him in another file, and thought, at some point I'll come back to him. And I did, and he's now got his own novella. And, you know, I'm so happy to be able to do that, because I just love that character's voice. My one rule, I guess, is that I like to write about subjects that I'm passionate about, that really interest me. And I think that commitment to a subject or to an iconography will give any story an extra weighting and an extra personality, because I'm genuinely interested in it. It's not just something that I've thought, oh, that'll make a good story. It's something I actively want to write about. So themes and subjects do tend to recur in my fiction, but I think all writers do that. What writing is a process of discovering our own leitmotifs, our own iconography. I find that intensely exciting when I read it, when I read a writer like Nabokov, and I keep coming upon repeating themes, repeating elements of autobiography. I find it scintillating and magical. And again, it's something that I really like to attempt in my own fiction. It's a way of pinning down memory, a way of pinning down moments and those sort of sensations and ideas that are of most central importance in my own life.
I love this idea of writing partially being the process of discovering your own iconography.
It really is for me. It always has been.
Well, I'd never considered it to be as such before, but like when you said that, it really resonated with me. And I realised that I have been doing that, you know, in all the stories that we've been writing for this, for the Tiny Bookcase. It's interesting when you write something and you're like, oh, that's a me thing.
Yeah.
And you start to sort of see them, and they crop up, and you play with them and hopefully make them better.
It's exactly that. And it must be so fascinating for both of you to look back on the catalogue of flash fictions you have both written for this podcast. I think it's, apart from anything else, it gives you the discipline of writing regularly and actually, you end up with, you know, a body of work. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's certainly been something. I hope that I hope that we've both been getting better as we go along, because that's a big part of doing any kind of craft, isn't it? It's
certainly is.
Yeah,
it's practice. It is practice. It's just that, you know, doing it. It's like athletics. It's no different.
I do find as I've gone on, I've become like far tougher on myself when I'm writing.
Yes.
Like the process has actually become easier because, as you say, it's like a muscle that you can work out. But what you think is good, it sort of changes a little bit as if you do it and do it and do it.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, I often think like if I'd known when I started out how far I had to go, that the idea terrifies me. And, you know, that I'm just, you know, it's good that we don't know. It's like, it's good that we don't know our own futures. It's the same kind of thing. You just start out with this hope, this dream of doing it, and the confidence that you can somehow within you bring forth these stories. But the practice, that I often use a musical analogy. Music is a great theme that means a lot to me, and the idea of learning to write is like learning a musical instrument. You have to master the technical side of an instrument, playing the scales, playing the arpeggios, knowing how to get the right tone and form an embouchure, any of those things depending on your instrument. And it's only then that you can get your instrument to speak in the way that you would like to hear it speak. And I feel that very, very much in my journey as a writer. I feel now I am just about getting to the standard of technical competence that enables me to tell the stories I have always wanted to tell. And that's a good fit. You know, I've laid things as my third novel, The Dollmaker, I originally wrote the first draft of more than a decade ago. And I knew at the time it wasn't really ready, and I laid it aside. I also knew, again, I loved the character, the central character and the situation, his story so much. I knew I'd return to it, and I knew I'd know when the time was right. And when I did return, I was able to create the book that somewhere I knew had always been waiting for Andrew, that character, you know. And I needed to gain the technical chops to do that, and that takes time and it takes practice and it takes a hell of a lot of reading. So, you know, it's never too late to start, but it's never a problem to lay something aside and wait until you're ready either.
I find that to be particularly brave. Sorry to cut across you there, Nico.
That's all right.
This idea of setting stuff aside unfinished or not yet done, or, you know, this idea that you can just nix 30,000 words. You know, that's real bravery, I think, in when you're writing.
A lot of people do think I'm completely insane.
I don't think you're insane. I think very, very brave to do it. But it makes a lot of sense, and I think it means that you trust your instincts more when you can do that.
Yeah. It's surprisingly easy. I was saying this to somebody recently. It's so easy as a writer to get completely wedded to stuff, such that you keep reading over it and thinking, well, that's got to be there because it's there. And you sort of deny your own mastery of the situation. Like, no, it's only there because I put it there and I can just as easily get rid of it. And when you realize that, it's actually really freeing, because it just gives you more control over the process. And the other thing that I'd always like to insist at this point is that none of those words are wasted. They may not make it into the final version of the work, but you will always have learned something in creating those words, in telling that version of the story. It's never wasted. It never, ever. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, it's just something I've come to accept now as part of my process, and that it is a bit hideous at the beginning when I start a new book. And I'm excited about that. But I'm already aware that probably the first beginning, the second beginning and the third beginning won't actually be the beginning. And I've got to go through that.
Every time.
But, you know, it's all in the job. It's all part of it.
So other than the dreadful burdens of forcing yourself to delete 30,000 words on the regs, have you come up against any adversity on your path to becoming a writer?
I don't know about... I'm not going to use the term adversity. I use the term, you know, fear that you're not good enough. I always want to be one step ahead of where I am. And I always want to be that bit better. I always want to push further. I'm going to say those are good things, because unless you have that, you might just settle into a comfort zone. And even if I'm using themes I've used before, or using stories I've used before, I want to find new ways of bringing those alive and new challenges for myself in terms of formal expression. And I'm a writer, I care passionately about formal experimentation and structure and how stories arrive. These are the kind of little hurdles and pitfalls I will set for myself. And in reading the writers that mean most to me, you know, if I'm going to read Don DeLillo or Vladimir Nabokov, they are like 50 million light years ahead of where I am. And that's terrifying, but it's also a goad. You know, it's a challenge. It's something I need to, you know, if I can look at something and think, I'm never going to reach that, that in itself is a challenge to at least try my own version of that. So it's a kind of a push-pull thing. And at any one time, and especially if I'm starting a new book, and especially if I've just published a book that people have liked, there's always that blank, freezing terror of, yeah, but what now? You're only ever as good as the last thing you put on the page. Every new beginning is a beginning from scratch. So, like, yeah.
You really keep yourself on your toes there.
Yeah.
but rightly so, you know, like it sounds like a really good way to motivate yourself, I would say.
It's a great attitude to have. It's the difference between, you know, watching the World's Strongest Man contest in your pants eating a pizza and seeing it and going, I should lift stuff up. It would be a good thing to start lifting things
at me next time, Nick.
I mean, I was putting myself in group one there, babes.
at least a day of pizza eating is absolutely awful. It's
like, I googled it, babe. It's carbohydrate. It's good for you.
Yeah, quite.
How do you really achieve those gargantuan frames?
Yeah.
After Bjornsson is on an XXL double pepperoni, I'll have you know.
Oh, shout out to my boy Eddie Hall.
Brilliant.
Right, yes. So, if you had to pick one genre of fiction to keep, and you had to throw all the others out the window, so you can't write in that genre anymore, you can't read that genre anymore, there's only one left that you have to pick. Which would you choose?
You know what? I'm going to go for detective fiction.
Cool.
I've just been answering a question in another interview about what it is that... Because my new novel, the novel that's just come out last month, The Good Neighbours, is ostensibly a murder mystery. And I was asked the question, you know, what is it about detective fiction that attracts you? And I answered that what I love about it is its total flexibility. And people think of crime fiction as formulaic, you know, you've always got your murder, you've got your troubled detectives, you've got your lineup of weird suspects, and, you know, aren't they all the same? But absolutely not. You know, that you have your outline situation, and that's almost an armature onto which you can build any story. You can make it as weird as you want, because the reader loves a mystery. And as long as you play fair with your reader and, you know, give them something back in the way of a solution, I think the reader is prepared to follow you a long way into the territory of mystery fiction. And you can do anything in terms of formal experimentation, jump cuts, switching to somebody else's point of view, writing from the point of view of the villain. You can do anything. And I absolutely, as a reader and as a writer, I never get bored with it, I have to say. So, yeah, crime.
I think it's a good answer. I'm not entirely sure whether I'd give the same answer, but I can definitely see where you're coming from there, because you can just, as you say, do anything with it. Right down to someone like Bukowski writing these, like, pastiche parody sort of things. Like, you can make it funny, you can make it horror. Yeah. I like that.
Totally. Totally. You can make it the greatest philosophical literature of all time, like Crime and Punishment, you know.
As long as somebody done it at the end.
Exactly. As long as you give the reader a payoff of, you know, and you can even make the payoff ambiguous. You can hint at the solution rather than just nailing it down completely in stone and say that person did it. But you've got to give them something. As long as you play fair, you can do what you want. And I just love that.
I like this idea of playing fair with your readers.
Yeah.
I've definitely read some authors who do not play fair.
Well, yeah, I think that writing is a real balancing act. And I feel this, and I struggle with it, and I wrestle with it, and I interrogate it all the time. How much of it is for you as a writer? How much of it is for the reader? And you have to navigate that. You know, why is anyone going to read you if you haven't given them anything? Equally, you've got to make it interesting for yourself as a writer. That's really profoundly important to me. It's my own journey of discovery. I'm in it as well. I'm not the master. I'm going along for the journey as well as the reader. And, you know, and so, yes, we're in that way, it's immersive and it's interactive. We're in it together. And I want to give my reader something. It's important to me.
I think literature is just a team sport, isn't it?
You
know, you're relying on your reader to suspend their disbelief. You're relying on your reader to trust in your words. But in that same way, you have to rely on your reader.
To go with you. Yeah.
You're too wise for us, I think, Nina. This is.
You know, you have those moments where you feel like your mind is being stretched in nice new ways, and it's never going to regain its former shape.
Like when you're thinking about my tongue earlier, Ben.
Yeah. Damn it, the tongue.
Yeah. that's so lovely of you to say. Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you.
I think we're going to take quite a lot of your philosophy away with us today, Nina, but. Is there a quote that you live by?
Unto thine own self be true.
That was quick as well. So I believe you.
I think it's real. And I remember my gran, who was also the first person who ever told me stories. And my upcoming collection this autumn is dedicated to her. She used to say that to me when I was quite a small child, and she did not have an easy life, and I know that more after she passed on than I did when she was even alive and when she said it to me. And yeah, it resonates, and it's a good thing.
One of the few ways that one can be really sure that you're happy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think most people that have been unhappy, you know, barring like actual illnesses and such. If you look back at the times in your life where you weren't particularly happy, it's usually because you're in a situation where you weren't being entirely honest with yourself.
Yeah, you forced yourself into something you didn't want to do or a life you didn't want to lead.
For sure. You know, when we're talking about atting each other, Ben, do you want to not do that to me?
Get at it.
It's a truly wise sentiment.
Very much so, and it's nice that it's attached to this idea of like somebody that that you sort of learned the storytelling from at their knee as well.
Yeah. Oh, she was amazing. She just used to make stories up on the hoof.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You'd say to her, oh, you know, I want a story with a ghost. I want a story with a skeleton, and you know, I want a story with a haunted house. And she'd go, just a minute, and then she would tell a story. Isn't that beautiful? She read a lot, but But, you know, she left school at 14, you know, and yet she had this fire and hunger for stories and this innate knowledge of how stories worked. It's quite remarkable.
It's always lovely to see it and see it in people and hear about it being in people as well, because it's one of the fundamental ways that I feel like that we communicate, even without language, like really, like stories can push through boundaries that other things
totally
can't.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
so we've talked a lot about the way your thoughts on writing, where, you know, how you approach writing and why you write, and through that you've also mentioned a few of the books that you've got out there, because I know you've written a lot, you've been very successful and very well received, which is awesome. But for people listening, if they haven't read any of your stuff yet, what should they read first?
You know, I'm going to suggest that they try The Good Neighbours, the new one, because it works, I hope, as a straightforward crime story, a mystery story. You can read that not knowing anything about my other work, or never having heard of me, never having read any weird fiction, for example, any crime fans. You know, I've had people who read only crime fiction, and it's worked for them, which is hugely gratifying for me, because that's part of what I wanted to do. But it does have an extra layer of weirdness that will be very familiar to people who have read my other work, and to people who like the weird, who like something of the extraordinary around the edges of things, a sort of edge of genre feeling. And those things are very deeply interwoven in The Good Neighbours. And, you just get this extra sensation of weirdness from it, which I loved creating. I love all the characters in this book. Even the bad character is someone who has a point of view. And I really hope that readers would, you know, sort of respond to the ambiguities of that. And if you're particularly into science fiction, I would recommend probably The Rift, which is my second novel. Again, it's got a mystery element, but it's also got a very weird science fiction element. And you will meet those transparent woodlice again.
Oh, they're so creepy.
Sounds like a threat.
Yeah.
Oh, I can feel them crawling over my skin. I don't.
People have responded well to them, I have to say. So that's a good thing. Okay. I may bring them back.
I'll trust you, and I'm pretty sure I'll be checking it out as well. Oh, it's fantastic. So, we've had where they should start, but where can people sort of find out more about you and your work?
Well, I have a website, which is just www.ninaallen.co.uk, and I blog there regularly. I have a love of literary criticism. I write quite a lot about other people's books. I love discussing literature all the time. I've reviewed for The Guardian. I've reviewed for the Los Angeles Review of Books. I've reviewed for The Quietus. I'm not massively one for social media, not because I object to social media, but because I would probably spend all my time on it if I weren't disciplined about it. So I tend to write more long form and publish in other venues. But anyone, you know, wanting to find out more can always visit my website, and I have a contact page there.
Brilliant. Well, not to heap the praise on you, but it's been an absolutely stunning time talking to you, and
lovely,
and really digging into your approaches on things, because as we said earlier, it's been really enlightening. So just to thank you again for agreeing to come on and to give us your time.
And you promise there's no invisible wood lice in our houses, don't you?
You're probably okay. And would I do that to you? I just want to thank you both so much, because it's the whole experience has been amazing and something really different. And, you know, I've got a story out of it. So what could be better? Yeah.
Brilliant. Oh, that's really nice to hear. And a wonderful note to end on. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of The Tiny Bookcase.
Remember to subscribe, otherwise you're going to miss out on the future fun.
Also, tell a friend. If you like this episode, link them to it.
We'd be tremendously grateful. You can follow us on Twitter at BookcaseTiny, Facebook at The Tiny Bookcase, and Instagram at BookcaseTiny for updates.
Speaking of supporting the podcast, well, magic can only take one so far. The Tiny Bookcase is supported by the generosity of its patrons. Those kind souls have really kept my belly full the last year. Let's cast a spell for them, shall we? For magnificent beardery, let's cast the Chinicus Folliculari spell on Gary Laird. For rich ginger tones on the scalp, let us cast the Orangi Hedondo spell for Scott Byrne. And for general fabulousness, why not the Ooh La La How's Your Mother spell on Matthew McLaren?
How do you come up with that shit, man?